My name is Pete. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody, and it's great to be here. I want to thank Billy. I know he's in Blacksburg, Virginia, with his son right now, but I want to thank him for asking me to speak. It's definitely an honor to be able to come and share, you know, experience, strength, and hope, especially from the podium. And just want to welcome anybody who's new to sobriety, you know, new to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm pretty new to this area. Actually, I temporarily relocated. Don't know exactly how long I'm going to be here. It's kind of a weird space to be in the sense that, you know, I've put some footwork in for some future plans, not quite knowing exactly what's going to happen. Although that footwork is a result of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I would not be here trying to even think about going to school in this neck of the woods if it weren't for Alcoholics Anonymous. I would be probably somewhere else. And you could pick your blank where that might be, probably in jail or probably dead, you know, the way I was going with my drinking. And not only that, the way I was when I wasn't drinking. You know, that was a pretty combustible combination. A lot of anger, a lot of fear. If I don't do anything about that, if I don't treat those things, I'm not a very good person to be around. And I will... Things happen. Weird things happen as I've experienced. So it's nice to be here. And it's been great to become part of an active home group in Charlottesville and meet a lot of alcoholics, you know, Andy, you know, Merv, and just meeting new people practically at every meeting, you know, Billy and you know, people down in Buckingham, and just going to lots of good meetings, you know, that, you know, where there's a very solid message, you know, it's a message that, you know, got my attention when I was here this summer, and in the sense that, when I was looking for perhaps places to come back while I'm applying to graduate school, Charlottesville was the place I wanted to come because I knew there were some places where I could go. And it reminded me of the home group I ran into in Bozeman, Montana. I spent most of my sobriety in Montana. I moved out there in 1994. I was 2.5 years away from a drink. I sobered up on November 16th, 1991. In State College, Pennsylvania. I was my very first attempt at college, which I'll share a few stories about that, was not good. I didn't know how to show up. I didn't know how to be a student. I didn't know. I just did whatever I wanted to do, and it usually didn't involve following any kind of instructions. So of course I was failing, and then I had to go. So when I moved to Bozeman, though, I was 2.5 years away from a drink, and really not knowing that I am an alcoholic. I really did not know. I kind of had it in my head. You know, I had been going to meetings in State College, and great people. I mean, they welcomed me. When I went to that first meeting, I did feel at home. It was one of those experiences where I was like, oh, whew, wow, this is where I need to be, you know, and not that I, you know, rushed out and did the steps, and I didn't. I mean, that was not my experience. In fact, I wasn't open to doing those until my life in sobriety got pretty crazy, and hence my move across the country, which was an attempt to kind of get away from the things that were going on here. Because all the stuff was here. Grew up in Fairfax, you know, went to school at Penn State, you know, all the families back on the East Coast. And then I was all alone out in Yellowstone National Park. I took this job out in the park, and I thought that was going to make me feel better. You know, I thought being out in nature and doing all these things was going to work for me. And it was good to be out there. But let me tell you something. My head was going nuts. Nuts. I mean, I wanted to drink all the time. And, in fact, it was one of those moments of kind of like seconds and inches. There was a narrow little window that somebody had told me in State College that meetings in Bozeman were pretty good. So I went to this one meeting, and I just dumped it out. You know, I must have shared for about 10 minutes about what was going on inside my head. And the next thing you know, somebody says, well, this guy, Paul, who very active member in AA, shook his hand to me and said, hey, we have this speaker coming up from Aurora, Colorado. And it was a guy named Don Pritz. And I'd never heard of him. I just knew that somehow I had to get there. And I did. I got there late, of course. But I heard I heard some of the things he was talking about. You know, working the steps, cleaning up the past, you know, giving of himself in Alcoholics Anonymous, having a spiritual awakening. His life had clearly changed while mine had clearly not. And that is why I moved to Bozeman, Montana. I moved there because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got 12-step that night. I ended up spending the night in somebody's house I didn't know. There was people there that were pretty enthusiastic, talking about AA, having a good time, and I was pretty quiet on their couch, even though I was, you know, 2.5 years without a drink. I was an absolute, I had nothing to add to the conversation. I had no experience. I didn't know what my experience was, because deep down yet I had not conceded to my innermost self that I am an alcoholic. So I wasn't with you. I had one foot in and one foot out, and that became the path of becoming one of you. You know, I moved there and then started going through the book. And then my story started to make sense. You know, and that does take me back, you know, to the East Coast and some of the drinking that I did, because I never drank out there. You know, I stayed there for a while, and, you know, I started to go through the book, you know, of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the statements were turned into questions, and next thing I know, I am identifying as an alcoholic. I'm identifying with this obsession of the mind, this physical phenomenon of craving that occurs. It certainly occurred with me and some of the other people I drank with, but there was people that I was around that it never occurred with. You know, they were not the people that, you know, that were alcoholic. But for me, absolutely. And I started drinking when I was 16 years old. I had some drinks prior to that. I remember one drink. I come from a big Jewish family from New York, and I had this rum and coke when I had my bar mitzvah 13 and a half years old, and I had this rum and coke. Man, I loved it. I loved it. I'm not one of those people that did not like the taste of alcohol. I loved everything about it. Everything. The taste, you name it. Of course, the thing I loved the most was the effect that it did for me. I mean, kind of like a shot of espresso sometimes. You drink a shot of coffee. Wow, that feels good. But this, whoa, this, it calmed me down. You know, it took care of that nervous energy that I always had. That nervous, you know, restlessness. You know, this idea that I'm not okay. You know, this idea that, you know, my sister's going to be better than me, or I'm afraid of failure. You know, I can't. You know, all that stuff that's rattling around my head. That is the stuff that I wanted to get away from. You know, and I have been trying everything to get away from that. You know, as a kid, you know, I mean, I wanted attention. I wanted extra praise. I'd brown nose all the teachers. You know, I did anything to try to take something from the outside to make this ache that was going on the inside bearable. And maybe I would find, you know, stuff to take care of it a little bit. But I was in need of a solution. You know, I mean, we tried psychologists. You know, when I was a young kid, I was hyperactive. And, you know, I think, you know, acting out with mom and before you know it, they had to have somebody look at me, I think. I was sitting in the corner. I'd have to ask her how old I was. I think I was about 5 or 6 years old. You know, and then that started in the, you know, third grade. I remember doing that. And then, you know, in middle school. And then it got serious, more serious in high school. More individual, you know, a lot of therapy. What is wrong with me? I had no clue that I was, dealing with a sense of separation, this you know, this spiritual malady that it is, you know, it has been come to, I've come to see. I didn't know that that was what was going on. You know, I was trying to figure out why I was so angry all the time, and why am I so scared, and why, you know, and I those were the symptoms. I mean, those were, when they were coming out everywhere, you know, in the family, and then eventually came out of school. I mean, I really, you know, I wasn't a good friend. I wasn't a good teammate. I played baseball. Here's what I do. I was playing T-ball as a kid, and I was afraid to go on to play Little League because I was afraid of failure. But of course, I couldn't tell my dad that, because he, you know, I couldn't admit that, but that was what was going on. I clearly remember of being afraid to do it. So I skipped about 5 years, and then I started to play again when I was 13 years old. Then I thought I'd, you know, try out for the high school team. So I did, you know, up in Fairfax, Woodson High School. And I, of course, these players were 5 years better than me because they kept playing and they kept doing what they were supposed to be doing. They were, you know, getting coaching, you know, receiving help and instruction, which I was afraid to do because I didn't want any instruction. Leave me alone. You know, I don't want to risk failing or, you know, risk doing anything of that sort. So I actually made the high school team. I don't know how I did. I think I just did it because they let me on. Yeah, I was a yapper and I ran well. So I mean, they let me on the team. So, but I was not a good player. And I think everybody on the team knew it. I couldn't hit. I couldn't catch. I couldn't do anything. And before you know it, our team is playing. This is junior varsity. We're playing in the championship game. And this is where I'm at. They actually had me as a first base coach. You know, let's make him useful. Get him out of the dugout so he doesn't have any chance to play. So we'll put him in the first base coach spot. So that's where they put me. So I'm sitting in there. We're in the championship game, and I'm rooting against my team to lose because I want to get on the equal playing field with them. They're doing better than I am. I'm embarrassed that my girlfriend's watching me as the first base coach. She's cheering for me in the first base coach's box. I'm embarrassed, humiliated. I wouldn't have my parents come to the games because I was just full of fear, you know, of how I am looking. This inflated sense of self. And I rooted, and we lost, and I had to literally contain myself. I had to get the smile off my face and pretend like I was upset as we took the bus ride back from Lake Braddock High School to Woodson. And that's how I was. You know, very self-centered, you know, to the extreme. And of course, that kind of behavior, take that into relationships, take that into friendships, take that into jobs. Imagine the results. I might start off well. I might, you know, make people, you know, 'cause I'll charm you. You know, I'll say things that, you know, I'm pretty quick with my, I can say this. I'll charm you, but eventually it'll kind of wear off, and then the truth will come out. So that's the way I was right before I picked up a drink. I'm looking for a solution. I'm looking for something to take the edge off, to kind of be that equalizer, to take care of the pit in the gut that was always there. And I didn't grow up in an alcoholic home. You know, mom and dad, you know, didn't drink. Dad worked a lot, but, you know, it didn't really see a lot of it. Although, you know, in Bill's stories, he talks about his heroes being stockbrokers. My heroes were sports heroes. And they were especially I would read these books about people getting drunk and partying, and I loved it. I want that lifestyle. I want to be like that. I want to be somebody. You know, because I wasn't anybody the way I was. So it was almost like a switch went off when I was 16 years old. And, you know, I'd had that drink when I was, you know, bar mitzvahed. But, man, I went pretty much two years of, now I know it is, extremely untreated alcoholism. You know, it just got worse and worse. And then, man, when 16 came, boom. You know, it was time to get down to business. I mean, it was time to drink. It was time to get drunk. And I didn't know any of these things that started to happen to me. I had no idea that they were, you know, symptoms of alcoholism. share a few stories of what it was like early on. I got invited to a homecoming, Lake Braddock again. I don't know what's up with Lake Braddock. I got my ex-girlfriend, and I didn't have many girlfriends because I was, you know, scared, you know, petrified what to do in these situations. You know, be honest, I didn't know how to do anything like that. So she sets me up with somebody, and, you know, lo and behold, you know, I show up to this dinner drunk. You know, I literally threw out a beer, you know, Michelob, High Life, or whatever we were drinking, you know, right as we show up to this house. And I'm sitting around, spinning around at the table, wearing this goofy purple shirt and polka dot tie. And, you know, just, I was a blind date that I didn't care about. And I was going to be the goofball. Because something was happening. It was like I was that quiet, kind of a geeky person for a while. Guy who got straight A's. I didn't want that personality anymore. I wanted to be wild and cool. And I was going to do whatever it took to be that person. You know, because I did not like, you know, people kind of making fun of me for maybe doing well. No, we don't want anybody making fun of me. So I'm gonna show them. So I get drunk, you know, and I'm at, or actually we started to get drunk, ran out of beer, do the dance, miserable at the dance, didn't want to be there. You know, and of course she really didn't want to be with me. So the next thing you know, you know, I couldn't wait to get away from her. And it had nothing to do with her. What I really now know, I needed another drink of alcohol, and I needed it quickly. And before you know it, I'm back at my buddy Tom's house. My parents were out of town, and by this time, they would not trust me to stay home alone. No way. You know, trouble was starting to mount, and I was not exactly on good terms with them, so they said, find a place to stay. So I did. And when we got back from that dance and I started drinking, you know, I drank pretty quickly. You know, this phenomenon, I certainly didn't know it now. I've got a phenomenon of craving, but it was. You know, my friend Tom was drinking and I was drinking and I was pretty much doubling him in speed. Not because I'm a better person or better drinker or anything like that, because something was happening inside of me. Once I put the alcohol in me, this craving, this phenomenon of craving, kicked in, and man, I didn't stop until I think I was puking in a sink, yelling at the neighbors, and next thing you know, he throws me into the sleeping bag, and, well, I know this is being taped, so I'll try to keep this on a cleaner scale of what I did next. It was a blackout experience. You know, I think Tom thought, you know, I got Pete under control now. You know, he'll just sleep it off, and, you know, the mom and the grandma are in two rooms next door. He'll mind his own business. Well, I woke up the next morning. You know, the part in the vision for you in the big book that talks about the four horsemen, you know, bewilderment, terror, despair. I literally lived that on that very first experience when I woke up and saw my jeans on the other side of the room. I was completely soaking wet, for many things, and I completely missed the bathroom with a number one and a number two, and I mean it was a complete disaster, and it was right next to his bed, and it was just, I mean, yeah, I mean that's just waking up and seeing that, going, no. I didn't, yeah, I did that, and I wake him up, and he couldn't believe it, and, you know, Tom is just like, what do we do, and I'm going, what do I do, you know, I'm hungover, I mean, this is a week into my drinking, I mean, this is, you know, I mean, it's kind of all over the carpet, and just a disaster. So the first thing that we do, you know, and this is before I think everybody wakes up, you know, Tom and I, we go out to the drugstore where in our neighborhood, and I don't know if he realized it, but I took a beer along with me to come up with a game plan. You know, I needed to come up with a scheme to get out of this, because this wasn't going to be easy to get out of. I mean, because it wasn't it was a mess. So we come up with this. I take the morning drink, and I could barely put it down. I mean, it was like I wanted to throw up so bad during this. And we come up with, like, Tom, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? In my quick mind, I'm always quick to try to get out of something. And I said, well, tell his mom that the cat did it. You know, we're gonna blame the. And that's what we did. We did. Wow! This little feline. And to this day, I did make amends for that years later. But man, that was—I mean, we did. And I'll never forget. You know, them had to take all the rugs out and the furniture, and I'm sitting there going, and we told her the cat did. I mean, there's no way. How could they possibly have believed it? I mean, and I'm sitting there. You know, my mind is just spinning. How am I gonna? I'm really looking bad. You know, I wanted to feel good. I wanted that effect produced by alcohol. I wanted to shut the mind off. But I didn't want that to happen. I mean, that was like, man, no. And then people found out about it in school. They came up to me. I remember the next day, people brought toilet paper to school. And one girl in the lunch line came up to me and said, I heard you did this. And then deep down that pit, that gap, that hole that I wanted to fill was getting wider and wider and wider. Even though my mind said, man, I've got it. You know, this solution, I found something that's going to work, at least temporarily. And that was alcohol. You know, that effect produced by alcohol, that first drink, you know, that takes care of that restlessness, that irritability, and that discontentedness. And what happened is my mind, there's some stuff in the doctor's opinion, which I love, talks about is the cycle that we get into. You know, about, you know, saying that I want to control it. You know, I want to control and enjoy. And that's also in the book as well. I've got to get this under wraps. It'll never happen again. And that obsession, I chased that. I only drank for 3 years. And when I first came in, I thought, wow, that's not enough. You know, there's no way. And then when I started to see myself as a hopeless alcoholic, I realized, yes, it is indeed. That's not even an issue. That's missing the point. But my mind, you know, said it'll never happen again, and I've got to control this. I've got to get this under wraps. You know, and certainly I didn't want that to happen again. And actually, something like that did happen again. An Amtrak train coming in from Chicago to Washington D.C. And that was actually toward the end of my drinking. That first incident was in 1988. That other one was in 1991. Both I've had the opportunity to make amends with and for, and we'll get to that in a few minutes. But this need to drink, combined with this need to control it, you know, it kind of set me off on this cycle. I don't want to go into a big drunk log and list everything that happened. That was kind of one of those things that. You know, at first, even though that pit in the gut didn't go away, I liked the attention, so I said, you know, we're going to do this anyways. This is better than the alternative. So I combined that with a lot of vandalism of property. I was just an angry person. You know, all this rage, you know, this fear, it started coming out on innocent people. You know, people that I thought had wronged me for whatever reason. My junior high school for picking on me, my response to that was to break all the windows out in January, right about this time of year. In the cold, we took this metal pipe and just started knocking windows out. They put them back in, and I snuck out of the house and did it again and broke them out again, the same windows. And they were not happy. You know, this was in 1989. Stuff was going down. You know, my teachers were starting to wonder what was going on with me. You know, this is when this turbulence, you know, I'm going in the libraries in my high school and yelling on the top of my lungs. I mean, just screaming, you know, for kind of that shock effect, you know, kind of, you know, some of these reality TVs, you do this, and everybody's like, whoa. But I was doing it, and I was calling the librarian names. You know, and you know, I was, you know, she was one of those people who I thought was out to get me. That was my way of viewing. That was my perception of reality. That was my perception of the world. That is what I brought to the table every single day. You know, it was this paranoia, this fear. Mrs. Herman and her daughter were going to come after me, so I needed to strike first. And, you know, launched a firework into her house and you know, threw eggs and did all sorts of stuff like that. You know, just, you know, to make fun of her daughter. And these were the sorts of things, you know, I was getting attention. I was that wild guy, people would talk to me in class now. I kind of had arrived, you know, like Bill talks about in his story. I have arrived. It's like, but I didn't really want to do that, you know, because something deep down was saying, this is not how you treat people. You know, I mean, but I had no way to listen to that voice that was deep down within. That was long quashed. You know, we weren't going to, you know, look for any kind of answers from listening to that. You know, I was so full of fear and I had all that resentment. It was bubbling up and it came out, and it came out all over the place. And I never did get caught for those windows. And private investigators showed up at the high school, and they found out, they thought they had me and my buddy that did it. And of course, my MO was just to lie. You know, tell anybody anything, come up with a good story, and get out of it. And then I got him. You know, it's another victory, another imaginary victory, you know, that I thought I was winning. And so you can imagine that school wasn't going very well. You know, at the end of my junior year, my mom gets a phone call saying that there's 6 people we would rather not come back for their senior year, and your son is one of them. And I'll never forget this. I can tell you exactly where I was that day when she got that call, because she was bawling her eyes out, you know, when she got that call. And I am not a parent. I probably have what's coming to me if I get the privilege to be a parent. In fact, if that happens, I'll just have to grin and bear it, because I can just imagine how she felt. You know, that you know, getting that call. You know, her son's life is spinning out of control. You know, he's drinking. He's you know, this anger, this rage, and it's public. He's drinking. I'm drinking and driving in the family car in front of my mom's best friends on their lawns one night. Got drunk, started drinking, and boom, went up to their front door and started turfing. And you know, I thought, wow, this is great. You know, man, I stopped her. I got caught. You know, I didn't get caught, and thought I got him again. Yeah, I got him again. And you know, I did start to get caught. You know, I mean, I got, you know, 6 offenses in about, from like 88, 89, middle of 89 to 1991. You know, the offenses of, you know, starting off as little MIPs, you know, then shooting fireworks off it, you know, and then when I got to Penn State University, you know, it got a little bit more serious, became public drunkenness, and then got caught going to the bathroom in public, you know, intoxication, you know, these sorts of things. You know, we're starting to amount. And then, of course, in October of 91, there was a drunk driving, DUI, you know, in possession of fake ID. So this was starting to increase. It was starting, you know, it wasn't as funny anymore. When I left high school, and I did finish my high school there, and things kind of calmed down a little bit, the drinking increased, the vandalism decreased. You know, that solution was starting to really kick in. I loved the effect produced by alcohol. So I wasn't getting in all this trouble. You know, I wasn't, you know, doing goofy things like throwing eggs in shopping malls and just, you know, as often as I used to do it, you know, that year in 1989. But the drinking increased so much so to the point when I left high school, I had that thought that when I got to college, I'm going to show people I can drink normally. You know, that I don't think people who are an alcoholic have those thoughts. I did. I have to, you know, keep this thing, you know, under control. And I remember I got to Penn State, and this is the way my relationship was with my parents. You know, I couldn't wait to get out of the house. I mean, it was one of those things, just get me out of here. You're the problem. I want out. And that was how I viewed it. I don't see that, of course, today, thankfully, because of Alcoholics Anonymous. But back then it was like, I need to get out of here and get there, and everything's going to be okay. And then if I can get this drinking thing under control, everything will be great. And that's exactly what did not happen. I got to Penn State, and I spent about 3 days there before I picked up a drink, and I found a way to get a hold of some alcohol. And the one thing I can remember about that is I was so restless, irritable, and discontent. I needed a drink so badly. And then I found some guys who got a hold of some Rolling Rock, and we started drinking. Played this card game. I won't say the name of the game. It's a bad word. But it's a game that I ended up having to drink a lot in. And I showed up to my first class very hungover, and that kind of set the tone for my college career. You know, I was coming down. I was sharing a story with Andy about how I treated that resident dorm mother. I was one among many, you know, who wasn't exactly the nicest of people to Mary Beth, who was in Snyder Hall at Penn State trying to deal with a bunch of 18-year-olds. Really kindergartners. I was where I was. I was in a romper room with no business trying to go to college and try to, you know, keep the image up to the family, keep the outsides looking good, because my family's all lawyers and doctors and, you know, people like that. And I've got to keep this image up. So, you know, but man, I was ready to, romper room. You know, Mr. Rogers, that's where I was. I mean, I get there and start pulling pranks and stunts and yelling out the window and just doing all sorts of stuff. And of course she comes in and, you know, smoking cigarette. Yeah. Our room was the smoking room. Yeah. We just a mess. And just slowly started to treat this lady very, very poorly. And, you know, to the point where, at the end of my freshman year, I took some shaving cream, kind of on a wall like this, and put her name on the wall with some pretty bad swear words along there too, which she saw, and it was just an absolute mess. That's how I treated people. You know, my mind, and of course I've seen it now as a resentment. You know, I get a hold of something and I'll churn it out. You know, it'll go over and over. I'll replay it and just like that. But with her, I mean, I just didn't know I was doing that, but I just took everything out on her. Everything out on her. And I'll fast forward to the amend on this one. I know I'm kind of skipping over some things, but that's how the story came up with Andy on the way down. Was, you know, 6 years later, I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm back in State College, and I called her up. You know, I'm in the amends process. I'm going through the steps, you know, with a sponsor. And she was on the list, along with a lot of other people. So I found out after she let me in to East Hall, the area, wherever she was, that her boss said, you should meet with him. You know, I mean, don't meet with this guy. You know, this is probably not going to be good. You know, because there were a lot of things that I had done. But something inside of her said, you know, it's very important that you know, I'll meet you. So she said, come on in. And I had this list of stuff that I had done. Some of the stuff I won't talk to me after the meeting. What I did, and you know, I went through it and told her I was wrong, and she was like tickled that I had come back to see her. She said, all the students that have come through Penn State, there's only one person that's ever come back, and she goes, you're it. You are the one person. And then on top of that, I asked her what I could do to make it right, you know, after all these things. And she said that was the hardest year of her life, you know, lighting fireworks off and just doing all she had to come in. I mean, just a mess. And she basically said, what I can do to make it right is to help others make amends, clean, help others clean up their lives. You know, that is your mission. You make it right with me by helping others do this. And then to pay for the vandalism, donate money to a charity. And that's how a lot of my amends ended up going out. And I remember leaving there going, this is amazing. And that's a little fruit of the ninth step that, you know, I know I kind of leaped ahead. It often happens when I speak. I'm not a very linear person. I'll just kind of launch all over the place. But that was a neat experience. But needless to say, it took a while for me to get to there. You know, before, you know, I'm treating her like this to the point where I'm going back and saying I'm wrong. What can I do to make it right? Some stuff had to happen, and I had to get absolutely desperate, you know, not only with alcohol, but without alcohol. And it took, alcohol wasn't working after a while. You know, that solution that I wanted and craved and salivated over and loved, you know, wasn't shutting my head off. It wasn't, you know, taking care of what was going on the inside. I wasn't getting that relief. And, you know, after I was getting arrested more and you know, those offenses were occurring and it wasn't fun anymore. I didn't want to be I didn't want that attention. So I thought the one thing that I'd really need is a girlfriend. You know, Jennifer's going to make this better. She's going to make it better. She's going to help me control my drinking. She knows about me. She's heard about me. She's heard about the wild Pete, this crazy, goofy guy who kind of does things spontaneously. She's heard all this, and we're going to control it. We're going to get things under wraps. And I kid you not, I started drinking more. I was so nervous. I didn't know what to do around me. You know, what do you do? She's a pretty girl. You know, what do you say? So dishonest, and you know all those actions that I took. You know, I just started drinking and driving. There were times where I got drunk when I had no plan on getting drunk. There were times I bought beer when I had no thought of even going to a store and buying beer with my fake ID. You know, I was 19, but I was a man. You know, because I could do that. And there were a few, you know, and then when I got arrested for drunk driving with her in the car, I was just so nervous, and I got to this party. I was in school at Penn State, and the party was around Chantilly on Route 50. And I started drinking, and that craving kicked in. I couldn't, I really wanted to control it. I didn't want her to see me get, slobbering inebriated, but, this time there's no stopping it. Boom. And I got behind the wheel of a car. She wanted to fight me, and next thing the cops are around me. And this is one of those instances where I know I wasn't going to make it home. I mean, I was in and out of a blackout and barely remember it. And, it's weird. I think that was, and I needed that experience. Of course, I tried to get out of it. I tried to suck a penny and chew some gum and hope that, I wasn't going to get, nailed. But what ends up happening is I completely fail the sobriety test. And he sees my fake ID from Morgantown, West Virginia, Mr. Douglas, I'm in the back of his car. You know, he's taking me in, and Jennifer's taking my car off. He's taking me in, and I kid you not, I felt a sense of relief. It's weird. It might have even been my first spiritual experience. I'm in the car going, I feel this is good. I can, I was talking football with a cop as he was taking me in, and it's bizarre. I know it doesn't make sense, but I had a sense that this war that I was fighting, this battle, fighting the world, fighting people, fighting my parents, fighting anybody in authority is over, slowly starting to come to an end. And of course, the next morning, and I go through all the shenanigans of that, and the girlfriend doesn't come pick me up, and I'm mad at her and blaming her. Now she breaks up with me, and it's her fault. It's everybody else's fault. It took about another month before I stopped drinking. In the middle of November, very unspectacular last drunk, four beers, and I was in the It just wasn't shutting my head off anymore. And I was a basket case. I ended up, drinking by then had become like a job. And I did not know what to do. And that night of that Friday night, I was supposed to go to work. I was a sports writer at the time, covering a volleyball match. And I showed up there, and I covered the game, and I just walked out of there feeling like a whipped puppy. You know, like, I can't do this anymore. You know, something's changing, and I didn't know what. My parents called me the next day, November 17th, 1991, and I didn't drink that night. And that was one of the first times where I didn't drink when I, because there were a lot of times where I got drunk when I didn't want to. I ended up doing it, and they had found out about my DUI through a letter in the mail. And, of course, I got upset that they opened my mail. And, you know, my defenses, my fear was starting to creep up. But before you know it, something happened on that phone call. And it wasn't me saying that I'm going to get sober for you, Mom and Dad. It was that the truth, there was that window. There was a narrow window where the truth kicked in. It's that I'm in trouble. I can't drink anymore. In fact, it was lifted from me. I have not had a drink since that day, you know, that night, the 16th. And you mentioned anything spiritual? I hocus pocus. That was my way of looking at that. You know, I came into AA a couple of months later. You mentioned God, and I thought you guys were lying. You know, but I can see it now that there was a moment of clarity. You know, there was a window for me. To that opened the door for me to get help, to get the help that I needed, you know, because I was sick. I am sick. I'm alcoholic today just as much. Now, I don't have the power of choice whether I'll drink or not today just as much as I did back then. But what was really happening then was that was a, you know, this surrender, this process of realizing that something's really going on. And so I didn't drink. And then I went 2.5 months. I had to go through alcohol safety program, do the court stuff, and they sentenced me to 9 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in through the court system in Fairfax and up in State College where I was going to school. And I went through that, and I barely went through it. You know, I almost didn't follow my sentence. But when I went, I heard something. In fact, I heard somebody speak to it at my DUI school, and that is one of the things that got me to ask for help. And what I didn't realize is that somebody of my type, somebody who's alcoholic like me, I need help. I'm in a pickle because I can't live sober. I can't live in my skin sober, and I can't live with alcohol. And I was right in that spot. And my life slowly, I mean, actually not slowly, very quickly deteriorated. You know, I was doing worse in school after I sobered up. And those first 2 years, I ended up withdrawing from college because I could barely put a sentence together. I was failing courses, failing theater, failing history, all these courses that I'm supposed to do well in. You know, I'm just not doing well. And, you know, I got a sponsor, but I ended up thinking that, you know, I need to go to treatment. I need to have this treatment experience, and the best thing that happened as a result of that, and I have the utmost respect for this treatment center in Reading, Pennsylvania. He sat me down and said, "Pete, whatever you do, you must go to Alcoholics Anonymous. You have to do that." And this guy Hayes Clark, I mean, it was another one of those moments where, because I really did, I thought that I could still do all these other things, and a lot of very well-meaning people were trying to help me. You know, I was in a lot of, you know, therapy groups. You know, I was doing a lot of different things, trying to figure out why I'm so angry. You know, and by this time, I wasn't even talking to my family. I went like a year in sobriety without talking to them. I wrote letters to my mom saying, "You have to go to Al-Anon or I won't speak to you." And that was, I think I caused more harm in that first year of sobriety than I did even during that year when she got the call saying we want him out of the high school. You know, because I think she was a basket case. Like, where is my son? What's going on? And it took a while. It took a long time. It took a lot for me to shake that. What did shake it was running into a very strong sponsor and a very strong home group. And that was Bozeman, Montana. because I left when I was out of school. I was kind of in AA, but I had started working the steps, and I heard of these guys, Joe and Charlie, and we went through the big book, and I was starting to sponsor guys, but I had a heck of a time looking at my part, my role. You know, defects of character, no, still them. Mom and dad weren't this and this and this. If it weren't for the Jewish religion, if it weren't for all these things, I wouldn't be the person that I am today. If they gave me more attention, if they liked my friends more, all of this stuff, this resentment, the mind that was just churning this stuff out, that's the stuff that was literally blocking me between God and you and everybody else. These are the things that were... And when I get resentful today, I'm useless because I'm locked up. I'm self-obsessed. And what ends up happening is that I need to deal with that. And of course, my response, you know, the response, the best thing I could do at the time was, I'm not going to talk to you. I'm going to punish you. So I didn't do that. You know, I ran away from him. And it wasn't until I met Paul in Bozeman, when he became my sponsor, and the first thing he said was, you're going to call your parents once a week. What? I can't do that. And now, you know, it's like sometimes I call them twice a week. You know, it's happened. You know, the relationship with my parents, you know, through working the steps and through making amends, you know, Paul took me through the book, you know, kind of like I alluded to a little bit earlier, and I was ready. Because my life sober was worse. It was getting worse. And I know a lot of people have this experience, you know, kind of being dry in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I would raise my hand. I was even kind of in the service structure. I was going to area assemblies. But I was dry because I had not experienced that spiritual awakening. I didn't know what the problem was. And I didn't know I didn't know the solution. And I didn't know how to get this solution. The only thing I could think about was me. You know, how am I going to get mine? How am I going to feel good? Am I going to get my hike in the park? Am I going to do this? Am I going to do that? I wasn't doing anything for anybody else. And Paul, you know, and the group that I was in, the How group in Bozeman, started to set me in a structure that would, they started to crack at that. And I've got a thick skull. I mean, I am not a quick learner. I fought him a lot. You know, I tooth and nail. I'm not going to be a greeter. You know, and you know, all those sorts of things. But that started me on the path of being an active home group, a fun group, a group that traveled. And a lot of people, we were getting sober together, working the steps together, you know, cleaning up the past. You know, there were a lot of people kind of, you know, doing those steps 4 through 9. And it was really fun to be doing them together, and you weren't alone, and hearing people's experience, and you'd go out and you would always be talking about amends, kind of like Andy and I were a little bit on the way over here. I love talking about that stuff. I mean, it's the stuff that is, I mean, the amends step for me, I wouldn't be here. I mean, that is when I really, when I started to listen to what people had to say to me when I went through that process of saying, I'm wrong, what can I do to make it right? Is there anywhere else? I think that's the first time I really saw deep down in my heart, not up here, but in my heart, the harm that I've caused and the selfishness. I think I saw, because I'd always said, yeah, I'm selfish. I can recite pages 60 to 63 left and right, and I'm this, I'm the director, you know, and that's true. But what was going on, I really felt it. You know, when I made amends to my dad, the two things that he said were, you know, the vandalism, he knew about all that. And I told him some of it. And you know, he wasn't very amused. And then how I treated, you know, my mom. And when I asked him, is there anything else that I could do? And not that it's been perfect. I have gone back to make a lot of those amends for the vandalism. I went back to the superintendent in Fairfax County. Didn't do that amend perfectly. I probably do it differently today, but it worked out. And I paid money, an anonymous donation for a scholarship fund. And, you know, to pay back for the windows that I broke. And I was willing to do whatever, you know, whatever it took. And then one of his assistants, the superintendent, said, I need to talk to you about something. And, you know, please come see me when you come back to town. So I was making these trips back from Bozeman to Fairfax. These are men's trips, I called them. You know, I'd see my family and run around and knock on people's doors and do these sorts of things. And she goes, I think my son might have a problem drinking. So I remember sitting in that superintendent's office sharing my story, you know, going, this is bizarre. I broke all these windows. They could potentially put me in jail, and here I am carrying this message. And those sorts of things happen. Lots of teachers. Critical for me to go back and clean up the past. You know, it kind of started to set a blueprint for my life. You know, trust God, clean house, and give freely. And I'm a slow learner. That's not something, you know, I cleaned up the past. And, of course, then I started sponsoring guys, and life got good. And then my life, I thought, needed to take off. I needed to get my career. I need to get mine now. You know, I'm getting the rewards from this. You know, I'm in this home group, but then all of a sudden, you know, I get my, you know, foot back in school, and I ended up getting a degree at Montana State. And I fired my sponsor and my home group at the same time. I thought, you know, I don't need this control anymore. This guy's micromanaging my life. I don't need this anymore. And, whew, I spent about 3 years from 97 to 2001 in a pickle. And it got worse and worse. I started going about, you know, there were times where I didn't go to any meetings. You know, I was working as a sports writer. Things started coming back in my life. I finished my degree. I had to leave this job as a sports writer at Penn State because I could, you know, was a student writer and I withdrew from school. So now I'm back. I'm getting mine, you know, and I'm covering these good games and people are talking to me there. In fact, I was going to meetings and people would talk to me more about the articles that I wrote than I was thinking about helping the newcomer. You know, I was slow. I was becoming very self-focused and very self-obsessed. I started to resent the people in AA that were doing well. They were active in service. They were sponsoring guys. And that home group that I left that met four times a week and gave me the structure that I needed, I slowly started to really loathe everybody that was in that group. And I would talk about them and get sicker and sicker. I was dying. And, of course, then I didn't stand, you know, I was supposed to stand in this guy's wedding, and I didn't, because I made a fear-driven, selfish decision. A buddy that was one of my old drinking buddies, and I had to make amends to him previous, and I had to make amends to him after that for not doing that. And that got my attention. There was a lot of things. I started taking a lot of goofy actions, and lo and behold, got back into Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't drink. I didn't put the booze into myself, but I was close. I was hanging out in more bars after work. You know, the sports writer shifts were late, and I was hanging out in more bars than I was going to meetings. And I believe it was just a matter of time before that thought of, you know, I can have one. You know, or not even thinking at all, because that's how I drank. That's alcoholism. And I ended up getting a sponsor who was about accountability. Yeah, and I started, you know, I had to clean up some stuff again. And my relations with my sister and family, I mean, the family was kind of, that had petered out. That momentum that I had, they were bad again. And I needed to start to show up. And today, those relations are quite amazing. The relations with my sister, you know, she hated me. You know, for a long time, I embarrassed her. And then about 3 years ago, in 2004, she confided something very personal to me. And she did so knowing that I could keep her confidence. And I remember after hearing that, going, "That's a miracle." And not the miracle of, "Oh no, I'm this great person." It's that's a change that would not have happened. You know, had it not been for the steps and for this process. And getting back into an active sponsorship, you know, getting back into an active home group and you know, showing up in my life, you know, 'cause my life was a mess. You know, and you know, at that time, wrap it up in a minute or two. So I get Kurt as a sponsor, and that was back in 2001. And then I end up in another relationship. And that was actually a really good relationship. Betsy was a wonderful person. I probably saw more of the defects of my character. Step 6 and 7 became very clear in that relationship. Woo! Jealousy, resentment. She talks to somebody else. Wait a minute. What is she doing? I felt so inadequate. She was a professor. I wasn't her student, but I had to try to prove that stuff of show how smart I am. Because I was in graduate school at Montana State, and in history, thinking that I'm going to impress her. With all these theories that I didn't know anything about, and she knew I didn't know anything about, but I was going to do it anyways because that's what I do. Shoot from the hip. And that relationship, it did end, and it was sad, and it was one of those things that, it ended in March of 2004, and it took me a while to really get to the truth. In fact, I ended up in India, and I thought I was going to move to India. This is another one of those moments where, thank God, I didn't sell my condo in Bozeman. And I ended up coming back, and this experience taught me a lot. I blew up my life yet one more time in sobriety. I had a lot of commitments. I had sponsees. I had guys I was working with in the jail, which has become extraordinarily meaningful, sharing experience, strength, and hope in the jail. And I broke all those commitments. But I went back, admitted I was wrong, And then I started getting back to the business of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a slow learner that AA needs to be first in my life. It took that. It took nearly another incident, a goofy incident of AA first, school second, everything second. And when I did that, and I started going to meetings, and I started working with guys again, everything else kind of fell into a line. And I graduated in May. They couldn't be at my celebration, but the guys in the jail were just as much a part of that as anybody in the seminars that I went to school with. Because I was with them a lot. And working with guys, going through the book, and having that experience, which is indescribably wonderful. Working with others is better than anything I could ever conjure up for myself, even though I still do. So I think, this is... I left in May, I've kind of been a nomad ever since. I've been wandering around, parts unknown, and it's just it's great. I'm a type of guy though that you give me some wiggle room, I'll wiggle my way around and come up with my own idea, come up with my own primary purpose. And I'm just grateful that I've run into people like you here, that have really kept me focused on what the real primary purpose is. And that I'm very thankful. That's all I have tonight.